Tune to Witchcraft on the Air. Course 2 of 5. A series held on Free Radio Santa Cruz every other Tuesday at 11 p.m. Tonight, you will need a pen, at the very least, and a piece of paper in some portion to write these things down. It's not a passive course. You'll need to remember some of these things, even if you have them on tape for future reference. It's a good thing to write them down, because we're going to be covering symbolism reasonably extensively tonight. Wild places were held sacred by our ancestors as a source of life, since, as we mentioned in the last class, the divine spark of the god and goddess was believed to reside in every living thing. To be immersed in a forest where everything was alive was to be immersed in the power of the god and goddess. The Druids went down in Christian history as being the worshippers of trees, but if we can look further past what can readily be seen by the eyes, we suddenly get a much bigger picture. Everything that exists on the spiritual plane has a physical part that exists on the physical plane. To come into contact with the physical side, or to move or change the physical component, is believed to have an effect on the non-physical. This concept also carries over to objects. Everything that exists in physical form has a non-physical form on an astral plane. Since this place is a mirror image of the astral plane, each physical object also has an astral form. Simply knowing this concept means nothing. A witch seeks always to create with knowledge, not just for knowledge's sake alone. It is believed that the astral planes can be affected by focused, direct thought. Many magical practices involve concentrating and raising energy to focus enough to create what is called a thought form, casting that thought form into existence on the astral plane. The existence of the non-physical thought form on the astral plane causes a manifestation on the physical plane to occur and creates the existence of physical. Ideas cast on the astral plane will manifest as actions on the physical. Words will manifest as deeds, but it's not as simple as that. The astral planes and the subconscious are closely linked and use their own secret language of symbols and signs. Many symbols seem to be universally known by humans instinctively and have similar interpretations worldwide, such as the circle and the equal arm cross. But within each subconscious exists a personal language known only by the user. The user, usually not knowing that they know the language, dreams speak to us in these symbols. These have to be found by the individual. Many practices involve the creating of symbols, either new or old, that represent a need or the wanted outcome of a certain event. The working of magics upon these objects, charging with energies, anointing with oils, potions, etc., and then the casting of these symbols onto the astral plane. Sometimes manipulation of symbols toward or away from other symbols or objects or into certain situations, and then casting the whole idea onto the other plane. All of which is known as sympathetic magic, and is one of the oldest types of magic. Many primitive hunting magics involved creating an image or model of an animal to be hunted. The shaman would then take the tribe and the image across into the spirit world, where the hunters would hunt down and kill the image, returning to the physical world and performing the same hunt, believing they would be equally successful. There's also a belief that symbols are a way of transmitting to the subconscious. The subconscious then retransmits the concepts associated with the symbol to the astral or spiritual planes. Some of the more commonly magically used symbols include color. Some colors evoke a natural subconscious response and communicate entire meanings unconsciously, just make us feel a certain way, like red. Red is exciting, energetic. It's commonly used to represent fire. It is passion, lust, hate, revenge, explosion, and destruction all in one. It is used by the advertising industry to get our attention. They use it in phone books and ads because the advertisers went to psychology class. Pink. Pink is love and happiness, joy and cotton candy. It is one of the colors that prisons are painted just to make everyone happy. White is the absence of color, raw energy. The entire color can be changed by one drop of any other color. It's often used for protection. Green. Green is trees, dirt, and money. It's often used to symbolize earth and everything that earth symbolizes. Is growth, fertility, and also stagnant water. Blue. Blue is peace and protection, cleansing and luck. Is often used to symbolize water. Is also sluggishness and love. And another one of those school and prison colors, just to make everybody happy, peaceful. Purple. Purple is often used for wisdom and power, the higher self. It's used to represent spirit and the dark goddess. And once upon a time, only royalty was allowed to wear the color. Black. Black is mystery and darkness. It is often used to symbolize the base element of earth. It's a color that absorbs the energy it contacts. It can be protective or used for a hex. It's all together, or it is all color together, has been associated with death and the mysteries beyond. The circle. The circle represents wholeness, completeness, the cycles of the universe. Represents protection, focus, and the feminine principle. Circles, ovals, and all circle-derived symbols tend to represent the goddess and female concepts. A circle with an equal arm cross is basically a plus sign through the middle. Represents everything as well as the four, everything the circle represents as well as the four directions and the four elements and the four high holidays, and most importantly for protection, a cross, most important symbol on there for protection, a cross, not a Christian cross, but equal on all sides. A cross referred to, the cross referred to is two crossed lines, a powerful protection symbol used in many cultures, and is also used to symbolize the earth. The triangle. The triangle is often used for manifestation, and as such represents the triple goddess and the feminine principle, pointed up for spiritual manifestations, pointed down for physical manifestations, or away from you for spiritual, towards you for physical. It's also often etched on the floor to contain certain manifestations, but that's another story. The sun is often used to symbolize God, and the moon, the goddess. Things we'll cover quite extensively, I'm sure.
most commonly the pentacle, a five-pointed star representing the five elements, bound by a circle, another powerful protective symbol, and together, twice the powerful protective symbol. It has been adopted as a symbol of Wicca. Now, are you paying attention? This could be important someday. You might want your pen at this time, a piece of paper or something to write upon. Write it on the wall for future generations to remember you by. Draw this, a five-pointed star large enough to write in the points. Just a five-pointed star. I'm sure you were taught in school, one point up. A five-pointed star, one point up, 2 points down, and close it within a circle. Draw a circle around, touching each of the points, linking them all together. Now in the lower left point of the pentacle, write Earth. In the upper left, write Air. Very hard. In the lower right, write fire. In the upper right, write water. In the top point, spirit. Some common symbolic colors for the elemental points include green or brown for earth, yellow, light blue for air, kind of a brown color if you live in Los Angeles, red for fire, reddish orange, combinations of reds. Blue, or aqua, for water. And purple, or white, sometimes silver or gold, for spirit. Constructing the pentacle in this manner sends powerful messages to the subconscious, combining three types of symbolic magic in one. The transmission of these messages is a vital component in magic, and many methods are covered to make that happen. Symbolism we could spend a lot of time on, but now that we understand the basic concepts, the underlying symbolism behind everything we do from this time on will be hard to miss. Animal symbolism and plant symbolism come into play in quite a big way. In earth-based religions, many deity constructs incorporate animal symbology. Pagan gods and goddesses are often depicted in the company of certain animals, or depicted with animal parts, symbolizing parts of the personality of the deity based on the parts of the personality of the animal that are known. Horns and antlers tend to represent the male principle and the generative force in nature, virility, fertility, and strength. This symbology is found quite often in the visual imagery of many Wiccan gods. In general, anything lengthy or phallic, straight long lines tend to represent the male deity principle, and curves, circles, spirals, and swirls, the female deity principle. Mountains and oceans are goddess manifest in form. Tall trees are god manifest in connection with the goddess. Seems a curious thing, but way back before all-out war was declared on pagans, pagan meaning a country dweller, so by default a follower of the old religion, But before all that war, it seemed the best way for the church to lash out at the pagans was to cut down their sacred trees and rape their mountains. This was the greatest slight that could be dealt to our ancestors and could be dealt to the old gods. And this says a lot. Whole tribes were slaughtered in defense of these sacred things. For in these sacred places lived many other sacred creations of the goddess, who could not exist without the land. And these creatures are symbolic for many other concepts. Snakes, in symbolic language, are seen to represent wisdom, deep earth mysteries, knowledge, possibly stemming from hibernating practices deep inside the Mother Earth through the months of winter and the season of death. Ravens tend to be associated with death due to centuries of feeding upon the dead on battlefields and such, but are also seen as the bringers of messages. If you have dwelt in the forest, you will understand this. If someone is coming, a raven will let you know, usually in enough time to escape, but might also tell others where you are, depending on your relationship with the raven. If you've developed an affinity with your local birds, or they have become familiar with you, they will pay you no mind and will alert you to any strangers. Hawks are the seers of far-off events, the finders and pursuers of small hidden mysteries, hunters and protectors. They can tell you if somebody's coming 10 miles away, if you've developed an affinity with the hawk. Owls. Owls symbolize wisdom and knowledge, an imagery that is not faded to this day. Even cartoon owls tend to wear glasses and are bookworms, spending their waking hours in the forest darkness, seeing a world that few will ever see. They hunt the mysteries of death and life, protectors and defenders during the long night, with large, all-seeing eyes that look right through you. They're quite often associated with the goddess, as the mysteries of night and darkness are hers. Horses, wild ones, represent freedom and the power freedom brings. Speedy change is seen as carried on the back of the horse. Horses are the bringers of sudden change. Bats. Bats tend to symbolize rebirth. I have no reason why. Outside of creating astral symbols is another practice in sympathetic magic of like attracts like. The creation of physical symbols or objects representing desired events and outcomes, keeping these symbols on the physical plane, placed in specific places and charged with energy, attract their larger likeness. Like attracts like. Typically, these objects are placed on an altar or another charged space with stones and other symbolic objects. Utilizing the naturally occurring psychological symbols in magic is powerful, but as we are a creative branch of magical practice, we find the creation of certain personal symbols and objects to be a magic field all on its own. The main key in this very wording, creation, creativity. In the craft, we are afforded the rare opportunity of personal divine inspiration. Old school craft strains have always put an emphasis on creative energy. To form ideas into matter is an old school craft construct. A song can be a powerful symbol, a poem, a verse, a rhyme. It's a powerful way to send a concept off to the subconscious mind. A drawing, painting, sculpture works very well. The basic idea is the more creative energy sunk into the project, the more creative energy creating your will into physical existence. Various methods exist for the creation of written symbols, combinations thereof. First, one has to select a magical alphabet. Some of the more common include the runes, several versions of runes available, or the Theban script. Less common include Oum. It's very good for carving. The important thing is that for you it represents a language that has no mundane use. It is only magical and is only used for magic. Once adapted, can be used in all magical works. Quite often, a few alphabets can be found in your local occult bookstore. Most starter books tend to cover it, at least give you one version. Seems Buckland's Complete Book of Witchcraft had more complete magical alphabets than even the Book of Magical Alphabets last time I checked. Some of these can even be found in some encyclopedias. When I was a kid, I first found the Theban script in it. It was an encyclopedia or a dictionary. I'm pretty sure it was a Encyclopedia Britannica, a later edition. They called it the Witch Alphabet, straight out of Gerald Gardner. All of which, all of the different alphabets are really too hard to describe on radio or on a tape. You'll have to research them yourselves. For the following exercise, runes works quite well due to all the straight lines. Alphabets with straight lines are easiest to do this with. Write out something very specifically that you want. An event that you want to occur. A thing that you want. And if you do it right now when we're taping the show, it wouldn't be a bad mood cycle to do that in. Be very specific what you want. But not specific as to how it is acquired. But you want to make sure that nobody's harmed. Lesson one, remember? You want to make this all into a sentence. Write it out in your pre-chosen, non-mundane, magical language of choice. A song or a poem, as we mentioned, can be written out in runes. Now take each letter. One at a time. And over the top of each other, write the letters. Start with one, write it out. Write the next letter over top of the other one. On top of each other, connected to it, some artistic fashion that works for you. Point being that they need to connect with each other and be as easy to redraw if you ever have to again as you can do. So you don't want them too complicated. Writing each letter over top of each letter until all of them are included, connected in some basic symbol. Repeating letters more than two in the sentence can be overlapped on the last letter that matches it. Portions of the letters can overlap. Getting the point, there's not a whole lot of rules here. Portions of the letter can be drawn over top of the other letter until one symbol exists that hopefully could be drawn again, remembered again, written several ways, and put in your book of shadows, or your notebook. Now you have a basic symbol. other known symbols can be incorporated into the design in any manner you can create. A circle around it to bind, focus the energy. A downwards triangle to manifest physical things. Upwards for spiritual, etc. The same idea drawn in Dragon's Blood ink is even better. Same idea drawn in Dragon's Blood ink with 3 drops of your own blood in it. Why? That's real good. There are other magical inks out there, but it's the most readily available, even in magic stores. There's not too many other inks on the shelves. Drawn with a magic pen, a consecrated pen, has no other use but for writing magic. It was never used to write out your bills. It would, you know, hopefully be a quill anyways if you're using it with Dragon's Blood ink, and that probably wouldn't go over well with the bill collectors. Actually, it might be a good idea. Sign your name in Dragon's Blood ink and send it to your bill collector. That's another class. Even better. even better with the Dragon's Blood ink. One advantage of written symbols is that they can be removed from the physical plane quite easily by burning them or destroying them in other creative ways at key points during the ritual and casting them into the other realm. Burning is quite effective because the physical body no longer exists. It becomes vapor, smoke, and fire. Your symbol has been transformed, whether you call it magic or science hardly matters. It's not there anymore. Before doing all that, the symbol is concentrated upon in a ritual setting, programming the symbol into your subconscious. Various methods are used for this, focusing on the symbol at a high point of a ritual or during an altered state of consciousness, or when a high point in stimulation has been achieved. For instance, after dancing when you can no longer stand, while singing when a heightened state has been achieved, during sexual or masturbatory stimulation, after building to the point of climax and stopping several times, when a peak is finally reached and you can stand it no more, just before orgasm or at the moment of, programs it into your subconscious. There are other methods. I believe the CIA likes to use pain and uses electronic zap methods, and pain can also program things into your subconscious, but the things that I just mentioned before, far more pleasurable. I suppose that's up to you. It would be hard to do the first key, relaxation. Focusing on the symbol just before sleep, having it be the last thing that you look upon, also can program it into your subconscious. All of which are advanced techniques that will require practice and hard work and study on your part. It can hardly be covered quite completely here. But let's go to step one. We now theoretically have a magically created symbolic object. But it is still raw and formless. And until we breathe life into it, it is still not magic. Now the object needs to be charged. Now, hopefully, after last class, you have worked on your first key and have become an adept in the arts of relaxation. If not, try anyways. Apply the first key. Relax. Take 3 deep breaths. Very nice. I feel relaxed. Put some soothing music on and relax. And remember to relax. Come on, 3 deep breaths. I'm not going to go through the entire ritual for you. That was in the last class. and you should have practiced it. Not to make you stressed and not relaxed, but take 3 deep breaths. Even if you took 3 more, it'll help. Smoke a cigarette. Works for me. Now, remember last class. Did a very common exercise. Repeat it over and over and over again. We sunk our roots into the earth. Tapping our roots to the earth's core. Well, that's what you need to do. Apply the first key. And then perform this exercise. Yes, you do remember, don't you? Now, since you've become an adept in the last 2 weeks, sure, you're already relaxed. You're already connected with the earth. You're in a peaceful state. And you're rubbing your hands together. Like I'm doing now. Rubbing your hands together. And while you're doing that, you think for a moment on polarity. Polarity is a repeating concept in the universe. Positive and negative. Generative and receptive. Quite often, we use the left hand for generative and the right hand for receptive. You can think of that in your hands. Different polarities, rubbing them together. Astral arc welding, if you will. And one of the simpler methods, and it doesn't get covered in a lot of the books, so there are plenty of methods covered in the books outside of these, which we gave you a list that you could be working on. But anybody can do this one. Rubbing your hands together till they're stimulated, tingling with energy. Part your hands. Form a circle without touching your hands together. Move your hands until you can feel the polarity of your hands pushing against each other. A slight resistance. You don't want to go too far past that resistance. Pushing on it ever so slightly and never letting your hands touch. Begin the flow of energy through your body into your hands. The 2 minor chakras used in chakra magic, located in the hands and the feet. The easiest to use, the least amount of work. Of course, there are more. Back and forth, moving your hands. You can feel just a point where you just kind of can pump the energy of the other side of your hand and just start a flow till you see it flowing through your hands, in between your hands. Can feel the energy building up in your hands. Now your object can be charged by placing it in between your hands or your hands around it, continuing the process. It's not so very difficult. An old Huna teaching goes, where attention goes, energy flows. Just paying attention to your object, thinking of your desire, still moving your hands. I'm still moving my hands over the mixing board right now. Can you feel it? This same method can be used. Candles, stones, symbolic objects that you make, pieces of jewelry, anything that needs to be charged. Leads us to the second key. Concentration. We just did some, so you know you can do it. Where tension goes, energy flows. I'm going to start with an object. I think we kind of used a Bic lighter before. A physical object that you can see somewhere in your space. Just focus on it and look at it. Don't take your eyes off it. Look at it until something else grabs your attention. Time it. See how long it takes you. Perform this over and over again till you can increase the time that it takes for you to lose focus simply staring at an object. The more you work on it, the longer you can do. The music's falling apart. You've physically worked on looking at an object, need to mentally work on visualizing the object, same object that you worked at before. Close your eyes. Visualize that same object in every detail in your mind. Same process again. Look at it until you can't see it. Do you see something else? Do you think of something else? And repeat the process. Lengthen the process. From that, you can go further, develop an entire concept. As a symbol, and hold it in your mind for as long as you can. From there, right? Yes, I think so. All right.
Ah, yes. Side B. Well, you had a little longer to work on your exercises than we thought. I think it seemed like a long time. Hopefully, you're very adept at it. Well, it was brought to my attention to clarify the combination of symbols. to make a symbol, or the combination of letters to make a symbol. And it is a hard thing to explain, so I'm glad it was clarified, or I'm glad I was prompted to clarify it, because it's hard to work on clarifying that particular portion describing these symbols over the air. It's important that these aren't jumbled. They're not just a big massive blob of stuff. A's can be upside down and be written over top of a V, mixed in with W's, X's, hey, even some Z's. Well, that would be if you were using English too, I suppose. But the runic A is pretty close to a V. Anyways, the idea is to make these all into one simple symbol combined with letters combined on top of them. It's got to be simple, something that you can write again. I don't know what more to say about that.
Is that good?
Okay. It's clarified for who was unclear to, so hopefully for you too. Next, in this portion, it's a damn good idea. Damn good idea, I might say, to cover altar tools and altar setup at this point. Because you want to start gathering these tools, hopefully, before the last class, when you'll be using them and sent off into the world to use them at will. First, in the tools of witchcraft, the more common tools that we'll cover some of the common ones and some of the more uncommon ones. Most common, used for a lot of different techniques, is the athame. Just, I suppose you're going to need to write this down. A-T-H-A-M-E. Some people call it an athame. Some people also call it an athame, which isn't proper in many other ways, but athame and athame. Basically, an athame is a dagger, a dark-handled dagger of some kind. Best if it's metal or a natural material that's coming into contact with your hand. Because the energy used in magic is akin to electricity. It needs conductive surfaces to travel upon sometimes. The athame is used to direct energy, to focus it to a fine point and point it places. Many different versions for the athame. Some people, you know, like large ones, small ones. But a double-bladed, dark-handled, preferably black-handled knife. They are nasty-looking. Swords are used for most of the same purposes that athames are used for. And usually ritual swords follow the same idea. Double-edged, black-hilted blade. In some schools, it's important that it looks like a weapon, that it looks threatening. There's, you know, some debate about, you know, the threatening look of the athame. Witches are always worried about how they look these days, because so much of how they look to other people, you know, causes them to be burned and hanged and that kind of thing in history. So a little cautious about how they look sometimes. But the athame, apart from a general energy director, is a magical weapon, also to be used in magical combats and times when dealing with entities and forces of a forceful nature. It is a magical weapon of force. The idea of having a powerful and forceful physical object that can cause great harm was an older school idea that was an important idea. And so some people don't follow the idea as much. They want a tame-looking dagger. but it's important that an athame can kill or can heal, or can make the magic to do healing. Athame is never used to cut a physical object. Never, 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 never. It becomes useless and is no good. Ritual tools go through a process of consecration. Consecration is dedicating the tool towards a magical purpose and taking away any mundane earthly purpose that it ever would have served. So it is not a knife for physical cutting ever again. It is a knife for spiritual cutting and the directing of energy. Quite commonly, people's names in runes or other magical alphabets, like we talked about before, are written upon the hilt of the blade, personalizing the object, connecting the object to the user in times of persecution or in times when secrecy was necessary. A process of writing the name on parchment paper with dragon's blood ink, burning it, was used. The ashes then rubbed on to the blade was seen as transferring those letters into the blade where no one else could see it. Conductive metals are very important, but some of the better conductive metals are also very expensive. An ideal athame would be silver, hilt and blade, but would be quite expensive, but would direct some energy. Stainless steel and battle-readied steels are more commonly used and conduct energy quite nicely. For physical cutting is a boline. It's B-O-L-I-N-E. Bolines are white-handled knives of various kinds. Older traditional bolines were seen as crescent-bladed, a hard thing to find. Crescent-bladed bolines are more often used for herb harvesting, aren't actually very useful for ritual harvesting. Separate harvesting bolines are often used in a crescent blade, if you can find one. The boline is used for all ritual carving, inscripting, etching upon candles, any physical cutting that happens in the ritual space. And again, quite often the process of putting a person's name upon the item is used. Magical name, not a mundane name. Magical name we should cover probably at this point when we're telling you to write things on your ritual items. Comes a time when a practitioner picks another name. It's quite common in most traditions and even in non-traditions or non-traditional traditions. Even eclectics tend to pick a magical name. A name for their magical self, their higher self, the part of them that is connected to the goddess, whatever you want to call it, the different concepts used to name it. It is the non-mundane self. A name that you use when entering a ritual or magical practice that you call yourself by from that point on. You introduce yourself by from that point on until the other self fades away. This name used continually in ritual settings builds power and builds a personality all of its own. You truly in time become another person when you assume your magical name. Not a other person where you completely forget yourself and are disconnected, multiple personalities. Sure, that would be ideal, but we still stay somewhat connected to our other selves. We know who we are. So the boline and the athame are quite oftenly inscribed with the magical name of the practitioner. Sometimes certain symbols varying with different traditions. The athame is quite commonly used to represent fire. There is a division in craft circles of the athame representing air. Air or fire, the debate has raged on since the days of the Golden Dawn. and it'll probably rage on forever, and some staunch traditionalists only use their athames for air things, for magics of air, and some only use them for magics of fire. Some of them that symbolize them as fire use them for everything that they're going to use it for anyways. Athames tends to be used for more forceful magics, for more, where there's more emphasis done. One rarely calls upon deity holding a blade to its throat. It's not not a good way of getting what you want. Oh yes, Baleen. Baleen's air and earth. Yes. That's how I got onto Baleen. Yes, the Baleen being the cutting instrument. And I think we covered everything on Baleen. Quite often we used on, well, almost always on, as altar tools are the candles. Candles are a tool. They're selected by color for a specific purpose, placed very specifically. They have oils specific to purpose placed upon them. They're etched with specific purposes. Again, in magical alphabets with your Baleen. Some purists select only natural candles, beeswax candles. It depends upon your preference. Once you get to working a lot of magic and doing a lot of ritual, well, you'll want some inexpensive candles because they go quite fast. Candles, as you might imagine, tend to represent fire. Also on the altar tools is the censer. Censer is anything used for an incense burner, also called sometimes a thurible. Sometimes little cauldrons are used, sometimes big cauldrons for big events, but places for smoldering herbs, for smudging mixtures, incenses, and whatnot. The censer is a vessel for containing air and fire, the burning coals of the incense representing fire, and the smoke rising from said coals representing air. The wand. Other debates on the wand as well. Some believe that the wand represents earth, some that the wand represents air. Again, debates rage on forever. A wand quite typically is a wooden stick. Various specific types of wood used, varying per tradition. Sometimes there are silver wands with stones at the tips of them that people use. But quite typically, the wooden wand is used. Specific traditions call for specific woods, but I'll give you what I've got, specific traditional or not. Quite commonly, men will use an oak wand or a birch wand. Broom. The traditional broom is often a birch staff. Women quite often use willow branches. Ash branches as well. It's quite common. And this I'll give you for free. And this is the way it was taught to me. How to put together a working wand. First selecting your specific branch. Either you can buy them places, you can find them places, or you can ritually harvest them. Basic rule of thumb is to harvest during the waxing moon, from the time when the moon is new to the time when the moon is full, when the moon is growing. There are more specific magical timings, but we'll go into that later. But it's a basic rule of thumb. If you're going to harvest for a wand, do it during the waxing moon. Select your branch. Hack it off with one single stroke at midnight if you can. Hard to pull off, but you can shoot for that. That's prime. In the tip of the wand, the point that will point away from you, is quite often fastened a crystal, varying crystals for various purposes. You'll have to do your own stone magic studies. But crystals by themselves, all crystals, filter energy and cleanse negative energies. Different crystals do this in varying degrees and do various changes of the energy. You'll have to research that on your own, but crystals generally in the tip, pointy crystals are best. And on the other end, the end that touches your hand, you need to drill a little hole. And in the little hole needs to go 3 drops, again, of your blood. If there is blood sacrifice in witchcraft, you'll find it's your blood. Drop here for the ink, drop there for the wand. Not so big a thing, but no sacrificial knives. What? 3 drops? Yes. Okay, 3 drops here, 3 drops there. You're right. 3's a charm. 3 drops of your blood, which can then be sealed up with white wax. Closest to the tip, or closest to the butt end of the wand, and best if it's the part that comes into contact with your hand, it's a lodestone, a naturally occurring magnet. You can find it at occult shops and mail order houses, and I don't know where else you find lodestones, but I don't have a problem finding them. A lodestone in the butt end. Now that there is one functional method for making a wand. Another version that I picked up over the years only varies on one point. Same configuration, but coming into contact with the lodestone is a thin strand of copper wire spiraled up the wand all the way to the tip where it comes into contact with the crystal. The idea here is simple and scientific and occult as well. It's carrying electrical energy or electrical related energy. The branches of trees already can carry electrical energy and electrically related energy. So for that purpose, it's not entirely necessary, but would make quite a powerful wand. And again, person's magical name in the person's magical alphabet is quite often etched or burned upon the wand. The wood burners and all the other symbols that they can come up with from that point on, be they given from tradition or personal power symbols picked up from books. The pentacle, the altar pentacle, not to be confused with all other versions of the pentacle. We should be specific here in the language of pentacle and pentagram. Pentacle tends to be used to refer to a physical object of the symbol of the five-pointed star representing the five elements. Pentagram is the non-physical symbol of the same thing So if you were to draw a pentacle in the air, well, that would be a pentagram, because it doesn't exist here. If you were to make a physical symbol, that's pentacle. So the altar pentacle is usually made of some earthen substance, for it represents earth, even though it also represents all of the other five elements. Its base element for the altar pentacle is earth. Some people use stone or clay, and some people use wood. Varying versions, again, with your magical name etched upon the back. Altar pentacles can sometimes be painted the appropriate colors of the elemental points. But a thing to keep in mind when selecting altar pentacles is some people have too small an altar to get a large pentacle, and you don't want it to take up too much room or make one too large. But in some magics, it's quite effective to place the aforementioned symbolic objects in the center of a pentacle, in the pentagon of a pentacle, to be charged for, you know, periods of hours, days, whatnot. So a pentacle with a pentagon in the middle large enough to fit large objects in, or a candle, or whatnot, would be quite handy. A thing to keep in mind when you go shopping for tools. A bell. Bell, although not commonly seen in a lot of modern schools of witchcraft, has been used for centuries. Is symbolic of spirit and used for that purpose, for calling spirits, and in some cases for driving other spirits away. No other known use, except for the marking of certain peaks in a ritual, which can sometimes be done with a gong, too, or a crystal bowl I saw used for a bell once. Down the list, the chalice. Chalice in Wiccas usually used to hold wine. In some of the recovering circles, they use juice or tea or all kinds of other things. Traditionally, wine symbolized the blood of the goddess, the life-giving blood from the Holy Grail. So red juices and red teas were often used in place of wine when needs necessitate. Again, as we described earlier in symbology, chalices tend to be round. And, well, if you find a square one, well, you don't want that one. You want a round one. Chalices represent the goddess on the altar, in the feminine principle. And in some of the rites we'll learn later, it'll become quite apparent. Aside from the chalice, other bowls and dishes are used, for one for holding salt, one for holding water. Salt representing earth and water representing water. Salt representing a whole lot of other things, protection, spiritual cleansing. These can be bowls, dishes, cups, whatever works for you, but usually round vessels again. Some people use altar cloths on their altars. They can vary in degree, and some people have a pentacle right there etched upon their altar cloth, and then they don't need a pentacle. Caution. Be careful if you have low-burning candles and an altar cloth. I've seen some nice altars go up with the wrong kind of altar cloth. One needs to remember to clean the wax drippings off occasionally. They are a fire hazard, and never, never, never leave a candle burning unattended. And that's the disclaimer for the show. They vary quite often, seasonal. seasonal colors or seasonal patterns, fall things with leaves for, you know, fall seasonal rituals, flowery things for spring, black for moon rituals, sometimes even silver. They vary, and not a whole lot of traditional confinements on altar cloths, except a lot of black ones. A lot of traditions just commonly use black ones, but don't say that you absolutely have to. And I don't like it when they say you absolutely have to anyways. So, yes, the direction of the altar should definitely be mentioned. This is a point where Wiccan schools vary quite distinctly. The direction of the altar, the direction the altar faces, will also be the direction that the circle starts in, and the direction that all ritual will be focused on. And varying traditions have varying views on this, and the main variations in classic witchcraft and new witchcraft are the division between north and east. One school of thought wants their altar to face north, and one wants their altar to face east. And they all have their reasons, and you'll have to decide yours. A lot of earth traditions, druids, forest dweller traditions tended to use north, as north was the position of earth. And that's where they were. They were on earth. And north being the natural flow of magnetic lines on the planet. North is often sometimes called the position of power because of the natural power flow between the poles of the planet. And to establish a ritual setting on those poles, in sync with those poles, in flow with those poles, to use the natural flow. It's a good rationalization, and it works for me, and it works for them, but so is the folks that work in the east. Again, the sun and the moon in pagan traditions tend to represent the god and goddess. The largest natural representations that we have, that have their own cycles, that represent cycles of the god and goddess in our mythos. The sun and the moon rise in the east. So it makes perfect sense for the worshippers of those symbols to face the places where their symbols rise. That's the main basic argument. Some people vary the two. I personally work in the north and vary to the east for certain moon rituals and whatnot. I can't shift my whole house around, mind you, but if I'm somewhere else and the moon's coming up, well, I might just work in the east if I so desire. And damn it, that's craft. And no one should say nay. So the direction that you choose to face your altar will be the direction that the circle will happen, the direction that everything will happen in. Altars vary as well. Some traditions swear that the altar has to be a rectangle, has to be a square. An odd concept, since we naturally don't use that symbol for anything else, for it's not a naturally occurring symbol. But there's some rationalizations. You get more space on the table for certain things. In older traditions that kept their sexual practices intact, there were certain rituals where a woman was on the altar representing the goddess laying on the altar, which would be hard to pull off on a square. It would work best, of course, on a rectangle. But outside of that, there are no main constraints that anybody's seen fit to agree upon. There are round ones, rectangular ones, oval ones, corner section ones, half a circle, or kind of, you know what I'm talking about, things that fit in the corner. none of which are important. Natural materials are best. Wood, stone, of course, you know. The best is a natural rock altar in the forest, but, you know, you have to look a lifetime to find one. Quite commonly, there are ritual candles used in most Wiccan ceremonies. The basics are a candle for the god and a candle for the goddess. Quite typically, the candle for the goddess is to the left of the altar, and the candle for the god is to the right. But people vary on that point too, and it's hardly important. Usually, towards the front of the altar, or the part of the altar that's facing your direction of choice, are placed those candles. Would be the back of the altar from where you stand. And in the spaces near those candles would reside varying depictions of deities, god and goddess statues, or more primitive symbols, acorns for the god, seashells for the goddess. And we can go on even further from there, pictures, whatnot. Varying setups for the altar pop up here, and are debates that will go on forever. The basic premise is to have symbolic representations of the five elements on your altar in a way that establishes a flow along your altar of those energies in combination with themselves. Some people will have the elemental representations on their altar in line with the elemental representations in a circle at the four quarters. This commonly occurs in Italian magic, strega, where they also have an extra altar tool that none of the others seem to have, a spirit bowl, which in strega is the place where deity resides. Apart from altar candles representing the god and goddess, the spirit bowl is where they reside. It's a bowl of flammable liquid, usually liqueur, strega liqueur if you can find it. And other than that, their altar setup doesn't vary very much at all either. But again, salt, water, incense burner, fire and air, candles, that's even more fire, then your pentacle, that's earth, all proudly displayed around your altar in various setups. And really nobody should tell you how specifically an altar should be set up, because if you've ever seen enough of them, it becomes quite obvious that it's a personal growth venture, and the way you set up your spot to worship your deity should be personal, and nobody should tell you how to do that. Another altar tool, although not considered an altar tool in all circles, is the Book of Shadows. Book of Shadows is a magical diary of sorts, not to be confused with a grimoire. Which grimoire is more of a combined recipe and experimentation book, sometimes used to carry around everything that you'd ever need to do magic. Where Book of Shadows is a Wiccan concept. In the Book of Shadows, we should pontificate on just a little bit before we describe it, to see the origins of the Book of Shadows. Most Wiccan traditions, most pagan traditions for that matter, were oral traditions passed down through families and through friends and in villages, mouth to mouth. No words, no writing. These were peasant peoples that had not developed writing. By the time they developed writing, they were way under persecution and still couldn't get access to printing presses. The Book of Shadows originally appears during the burning times, during the Inquisitions, at a point of desperation. If you've read traditional books of shadows from traditions that had survived, they all become quite obvious. They believed that their race was being wiped out and wanted to preserve the memory of their practices. A Book of Shadows traditionally has to have that in mind. A Book of Shadows is an entire magical tradition in one book, combined with all the information that one learns, all the traditional mythos of your specific tradition or the tradition that you've developed and the research you've developed it from. It's an entire magical tradition in one book. It needs to contain recipes, rituals for all of the high holidays. And that really needs to be thought out before one takes on a Book of Shadows, because the idea to this day remains for the Book of Shadows to be picked up and remembered. Some people write their Books of Shadows in personal magical language so nobody else can read them, but the idea was to keep the craft alive, for the craft to survive even if the people were to be wiped out. And kids, we have not passed that point in history. Do not make that mistake. The internet will not always carry our records, and some of these older traditions proved to work quite well. For some of these manuscripts survived. Some of these families were able to pass these ideas down. They will all vary with tradition, but the basics are the mythos of your tradition, the tenets, landmarks, any oral traditions that can be remembered, be written down before they are forgotten. Tables of the elements, planetary times, all of the knowledge needed for a complete magical practice, all of the pagan holidays described, the times listed, the way to tell when the holidays occur, even when calendars don't exist anymore. And this part's really important, and most people don't even consider it in this day and age, thinking that everything that we've built will just last and the calendars will come in the mail. We need to work on astronomy and the observance of natural cycles. That is what it means to be pagan, what it means to be a witch. We need to be able to tell when these times occur, even when our society no longer can tell us that these things occur, when they no longer tell us on the news that is the winter solstice somehow. We need to remember how that is known and how that is charted. And that has to be your Book of Shadows. The Book of Shadows quite commonly, traditionally, has a specific color. If there's a specific color at all in any tradition, it tends to be black and silver most commonly, as black and silver are the colors of the craft. And in hopes that using the recognized symbolic colors of the craft would help the book to be readily recognized, even if its title was obscure. A black book, silver writing, quite often leather, sometimes hand-bound, and again, creativity's the watchword. Delve. There's actually even a book. I should mention that, huh? Because there's never been a book before. But now there is a book called How to Write Your Own Book of Shadows. I don't remember who the heck the author is, but I've seen it on the shelves, and it is out there, and it is an interesting book. For eclectics, you'll have to borrow all of the parts from all of the traditions that you like, and put them in one book in some sort of a format that it makes sense. And you, my friend, have then created your own religion, and that as well is craft. Ye old school craft. And I should touch on grimoires. Grimoire, not specifically a Wiccan concept, but a magical concept and utilized by Wiccans, and sometimes confused with the two. Grimoires, more commonly a research book, a recipe book, a book to keep listings of ingredients, magical times listed, a reference book, a personal reference book developed by you. One version of the grimoire as an experimentation book is for writing down spells. This type of grimoire should be started outside of the Book of Shadows by anybody beginning practice, to write down the things that they tried and then later log their results. When you start creating magic, you'll need to track your results without paying attention to them. You'll need to write them down in a book, forget about it, and then months later look back and go, oh, look, that happened. And then you need to write down that it worked. And then next time you'll know to do the same damn thing over and over again. You're tuned to Witchcraft on the Air, Class 2 in a 5-part series held on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, every other Tuesday for the next, well, until we finish 5 of those Tuesdays, for the next month or so. Witchcraft on the Air is produced on the Beautiful World program, which occurs every Tuesday at 11 o'clock, whether we're teaching witchcraft or just talking about it and reading news about it. Thank you for joining us. Merry meet, merry part, and merry meet for class 3. Blessed be.